all, not the most tactful way to endear himself to the writers, or indeed the performers. He never meant to transmit disapproval or disappointment. The tutting and moaning were just his way of gearing himself up for the work of the week ahead. Next, each scene, starting at the beginning, would slowly have legs put on it. As the show was blocked out in this fashion, Mandy would make notes and build up her camera script, and John would grimace and sigh and smoke and pace and growl. His perfectionism and refusal to be satisfied was part of the reason Blackadder worked. Every line, plot twist and action was taken, rubbed between his fingers, sniffed and passed, rejected or pulled in for servicing and improvement. We would all join in the process of joke polishing, or fluffing, as John called it. I relished participating in these sessions, which over the years became an absolute characteristic of Blackadder rehearsals. Visiting guest actors would often sit for hours working on a crossword or reading a book as we built up the epithets and absurd similes. I picture Richard and Ben reading this and snorting with outrage. Hang on, we presented you with the scripts and devised the characters and the style. Don't go pretending that it was all your work. Ben and Richard did indeed create the style, the storylines and most of the jokes. We added and subtracted in rehearsal, but they were the writers. There can be no doubt of that. My admiration for their work was and is extreme and unconditional. Nonetheless, as anyone who spent any time in Blackadder rehearsals then or later will confirm, the days were always a constant coffee and cigarettes grind of tweaking, refinement and emendation. Sunday was the taping night, the night we performed the show in front of an audience. Ben would act as warm-up man, introducing the characters and setting the series in context. This was important, for there was always a detectable air of disappointment emanating from the audience. No part of the current series would yet have been broadcast, so they would be staring at an unfamiliar set and fretting at the absence of the characters they had known from the previous series. When they came to Blackadder 2, they were sorry not to have Brian Blessed there as the king. When they came to Blackadder the Third recordings, they missed Queenie, and when they arrived to recordings of Blackadder Goes Forth, they wanted to see Prince George and Mrs. Miggins. For all that, it was a happy experience. The Saturday after the taping of the last episode of Blackadder 2, Richard Curtis held a party at his house in Oxfordshire. It was a glorious summer's day, and as we all wanted to watch television, Richard unwound an extension cord and put the set on a wooden chair in the shade of an apple tree. We sat on the grass and watched Live Aid all the way through to the end of the American broadcast from Philadelphia. "We should do something similar," Richard said. "How's that?" I wasn't sure what he could mean. "Comedians can raise money too. Look at what John Cleese did for Amnesty with those secret policemen's balls." "So you mean a comedian's Live Aid show?" Richard nodded. He had already been germinating comic relief in his head for some time. Now, almost 25 years later, he has devoted 6 or 7 months of his time every other year to an organisation that, love or loathe the enforced custody jollities of its biennial television pratfest, has raised hundreds of millions of pounds to comfort those who have sorely needed it. Coral Christmas, Cassidy, C4, Clapless Clapham, Cheeky Chappies, and Coltrane's Cock. With Blackadder 2 in the can, I was called up by Richard Armitage.
"Happy to say that they want to put on me and my girl in Australia. Mike will need you out there to help with changes that we can try out for Broadway."
I didn't really believe that Broadway would happen. How could Americans possibly respond to Cockney capers and rhyming slang with anything other than blank stares and fidgety coughs? Australia seemed like a wonderful idea, however, and Mike and I flew out with the rest of the core production team to rehearse an Australian cast in the Melbourne Arts Centre. I wish I remembered more about the production. I think I fiddled about with the lyrics a little and changed one or two scenes, but that is all that springs to mind. It was towards the end of the year, and Mike and I decided that it would be fun to stay on and Christmas up in Queensland. He chose Hamilton, one of the Whitsunday Islands of the Coral Reef. I spent almost all of Christmas Day in my hotel room, shivering, throbbing and shaking with sunstroke and sunburn, much to the amusement of Billy Connolly and Pamela Stevenson, who were staying in the same hotel. Back in England, Hugh and I turned our minds to the Channel 4 show that Paul Jackson had mentioned to us. Seamus Cassidy, the young commissioner at C4, was anxious for something akin to America's long-running Saturday Night Live. Our show, he decided, was to be called Saturday Live. I thought of him ever after, not unaffectionately, as Shameless Cassidy. Stand-up was taking over the world. Our brand of sketch comedy, it seemed to Hugh and me, was in danger of looking more and more dated as each month passed, certainly as far as the prospect of live TV was concerned. The problem with being a duo rather than a solo performer is that you speak to each other rather than out front to the audience. We had in the past written a certain number of sketches, the Shakespeare Masterclass, for example, in which the audience could be directly addressed, but for much of the time we played characters locked in mini-dramas with a fourth wall between us and the watching world. Out of some act of rare, reckless abandonment, we decided that before putting ourselves in front of the cameras for this new show, we should practice by performing in a comedy club. One of the premier venues at that time was Jongleurs in Clapham, and thither we went for one night, sandwiched between a young Julian Clary and Lenny Henry. Julian performed as the Joan Collins fan club in those days and shared the stage with his little terrier, Fanny the Wonder Dog. He did very well, I recall. When Hugh and I left the stage after our 15 minutes and puffed out our usual, "Christ, they hated us," Hugh, and "It wasn't so bad," me, we stayed back to watch Lenny. I remember thinking how wonderful it must be to be known and loved by an audience. All your work is done before you go on stage. Lenny entered to an enormous cheer and, or at least so it seemed to me, only had to open his mouth to have the audience writhing with joy and drumming their feet on the floor with approval. Hugh and I were unknown. Blackadder 2 hadn't aired yet, and the Crystal Cube and Alfresco had been watched by 7 people, all of whom wanted to kill us. That night at Jongleurs, we sweated blood as we treated the audience to our exquisitely wrought phrases, cunning jokes and deft characterizations, only to be rewarded with vague titters and polite but sporadic applause. Lenny came on, did a bird call, boomed a hello, and the building almost collapsed. This is to take nothing away from him at all. He had built up a rapport over the years, and he had the gift that can guarantee a good time in a comedy club. He was relaxed, and he made the audience relax. Hugh and I might have hidden our nerves and anxiety as best we could, but from the beginning we were working the audience, rather than welcoming them with any confidence into our world. A tense audience might admire our writing and performing, but they were never going to give us the great rolling waves of love they sent out to Lenny. Later, when we were familiar figures and went on stage to gusts of welcome, I would remember that night at Clapless Clapham, as I always thought of it, and thank my lucky stars that I no longer had to prove myself in quite the same way. Yet, having said that, there came an evening some years later where I was able clearly to witness the reverse effect. I directed a number of hysteria benefit shows for the Terence Higgins Trust in the late 80s and early 90s. For the third one, I had the duty of welcoming onto the stage a very well-known comic. He entered to a thunderous ovation. They were so pleased to see him. He exited to only a respectable level of applause. The next act was new. No one out there had any idea who he was or what they might expect. I did my best as compere to get the audience on his side. "Dear ladies, darling gentlemen, I have no doubt in the world that you will give the next artist your warmest and wildest welcome. He's a brilliant young comic. I know you'll adore him. Please greet the wonderful Eddie Izzard." They were polite and they did their best, but they would so much rather have screamed a John Cleese or Billy Connolly onto the stage. I stood in the wings and watched as Eddie left the stage to a gigantic round of applause. How much better to go on to polite clapping and off to roars than, as the established comic had, to go on to roars and off to polite clapping. Saturday Live was a bear garden, transmitted live from the biggest studio in London Weekend Television's South Bank Studios. It featured a large central stage, side stages for the bands, random giant inflatables floating above, and a vast arena for the audience of groundlings, mostly young, fashion-conscious people who milled about getting in the way of the cameras and harassed floor managers in a style that was becoming the established fashion in hip youth TV. A style that veered between sulky disaffection and hysterical whooping adulation. Hugh was convinced that they were more interested in how their hair looked on screen than in anything we might be saying or doing to try and amuse them. A month or so earlier, we had gone to the Comedy Store to see a new comedian about whom we had heard great things. His name was Harry Enfield, and he performed a stand-up routine as a most marvellously curmudgeonly and perverse old gentleman, a character he had consciously modelled on the persona Gerard Hoffnung adopted in his legendary interviews with Charles Richardson. Harry worked on Spitting Image as an impressionist and had, like us, been booked for Saturday Live. He had bumped into and become friends with Paul Whitehouse and Charlie Higson, our painter-decorators. And together, Harry and Paul had developed a character based on Adam, Paul's Greco-Cockney kebab shop owner. Now named Stavros, he was working well as a puppet on Spitting Image, and Harry fancied the idea of trying him out in the flesh for Saturday Live. Hugh and I rather envied Harry the stability of having one returning character. Each week, for the 12 of the first run of Saturday Live, we had to think of something new to do. Each week, the blank sheet of paper and accusatory pen, or rather the blank screen, flashing cursor and accusatory keyboard. The sketches that seemed to work best in the insanely hot, loud and unstable atmosphere of the studio were the ones, as we had imagined, where Hugh and I talked out to the audience. We developed a line of talk show parodies where Hugh played a character called Peter Mostyn, who interviewed me in increasingly strange formats. Hello and welcome to Stealing a Car Stereo With. I'm Peter Mostyn, and tonight I'll be stealing a car stereo with Nigel Davenant, Shadow Home Secretary and Member of Parliament for South Reason. Nigel, hello, and welcome to Stealing a Car Stereo With, and so on. I remember that Mostyn sketch with especial clarity. Most of our Saturday Live experiences are a blur of jumbled memories. The brain can be kind that way. Because it allowed us to film away from the feared studio audience and down in the LWT underground car park. With the show being live, it was rather tense. We had some sort of iron punch with which to smash the near side window of a car and pull out the radio. Rather than using the friable and safe sugar glass, usually favoured as a prop, we were going to do it on the real thing, a car belonging to someone in the production crew. Right, so, Shadow Home Secretary, have you ever stolen a car stereo before? Ooh, not since I was a young parliamentary assistant. Feeling confident? Give it a damn good go, anyway. That's the spirit. This is the kind of tool most car thieves use. One firm blow and then, quick as you can, out with the stereo. But while you're doing that, let me ask you, was politics always your first love? Oh, no, no. Susanna was my first love, then a boy called Tony, and then politics. Right. Has politics changed much since you first entered the House as a young man after that by-election in 1977? And, which was the purpose of these sketches, Hugh would continue an earnest and commonplace interview as if we were doing the most normal thing in the world. Later scenarios included introducing my grandfather to, photocopying my genitals with, and flying a light aircraft without having had any formal instruction with. It took about 6 heavy bangs on the glass to smash the window that night, I recall. I could clearly hear the alarmed voice of Jeff Posner, the director, in the earpieces of the 2 cameramen and assistant floor manager, each time the punch bounced harmlessly off the window. Jesus! Hell! Oh, for fuck's sake! Hugh improvised nobly. Would you say, Nigel, that the new European lamination standards have succeeded in toughening glass since your early days stealing car stereos? That's bang. Right, Peter, I would bang say exactly bang that. Plus, I've lost a lot of strength in my arms due to bang crash. Ah, that's got it. What I had lost a lot of strength in my arms due to, I fortunately never had to declare. The only other sketch I remember with any clarity is seared into my memory like a brand because it necessitated a visit to a hypnotist. I am not able, as I have discussed before, to sing. By which I mean I am really not able to sing, much as I am not able to fly through the air by flapping my arms. Not able. It's not a question of me doing it badly, but a question of me not being able to do it at all. I've told you what my singing voice does to those cocky and wrong-headed fools who have skipped about the place proclaiming, "Why, that's nonsense! Everyone can sing!" Hugh, as we know, sings marvellously, as he does most things marvellously, but Stephen just plain doesn't. I think I can sing when I'm on my own, in the shower, for instance, but there's no way of testing it. If I imagine for a second that there is anybody in the house, or in the garden, or within 100 yards of me, I freeze up. And that would include a microphone. So my singing is like a physicist's quantum event. Any observation fatally alters its outcome. Well, came the day in the middle of the second series of Saturday Live that I found that Hugh had painted me, or I had painted myself, into a dreadful corner. Somehow a routine had been written in which it was essential for me to sing. Hugh was performing some other crucial function in the sketch, and I could not but accept that I was going to have to sing, live, on television. For 3 days I was in a complete panic, trembling, sweating, moaning, yawning, needing a pee every 10 minutes, all the symptoms of extreme nervous tension. At last Hugh could take it no more. "All right, then, we'll just have to write another sketch." "No, no, I'll be fine." Annoyingly, it was a good sketch. Much as I dreaded the prospect of its approach, I knew that we should do it. "Really, I'll be fine." Hugh took in my quaking knees, ashen complexion, and terrified countenance. "You won't be fine," he said. "I can see that. Look, it's obviously psychological. You can hammer out a tune on a piano. You can tell one song from another. You're obviously not tone deaf." "No," I said. "The problem is I'm tone dumb." "Psychological. What you should do is see a hypnotist." At 3 o'clock next afternoon, I rang the doorbell of the Maddox Street consulting rooms of one Michael Joseph, clinical hypnotist. He turned out to be Hungarian by birth. Hungarian, I suppose, because of my grandfather, is my favourite accent in all the world. "Tell me the issue that brings you here," he asked, expecting, I imagine, smoking or weight control or something along those lines. "I have to sing tomorrow night."
"Excuse me?"
"Tomorrow night I have to sing, live on television." I outlined the nature of the problem.
"You say you can never sing? You have never sung?"
"Well, I think it must be a mental block. I have a good enough ear to be able usually to recognise some keys, E-flat major, C minor and D major, for instance. But the moment I have to sing in front of anybody else, I just get a hammering in my ears. My throat constricts, my mouth goes dry, and the most tuneless, arrhythmic horror comes out."
"I see, I see. Perhaps you should put the palms of your hands on your knees. That would be pleasantly comfortable, I think. You know, if you feel your hands on your legs, it is amazing how they seem almost to melt into the flesh, is it not? Soon it is hard to tell which is your hands and which is your legs, don't they? They are as one. And as this is happening, it now feels as if you are being lowered down a well, haven't you? Down into the dark. But my voice is like the rope that keeps you confident that you will not be lost. My voice will be able to pull you back up, but for the moment it is dropping you down and down until you are in the warm and in the dark. Yes? No?"
I felt myself slipping into a state, not of unconsciousness, for I was fully awake and aware, of willing relaxation and contented stupor. Light closed around me until I was snug and securely held in the well of darkness and warmth that he had described.
"Tell me when it was that you decided that you could not sing."
And now, quite unexpectedly, there popped fully formed into my head a perfectly clear memory of Kong Prak. Congregational practice is held every Saturday morning in the prep school gym chapel assembly hall. The music master, Mr. Hemus, takes us through the hymns that will be sung in tomorrow's service. It is my first term. I am 7 years old and just getting used to boarding 200 miles from home. I stand at the end of a row with a hymn book in my hand, joining in as the school sings its way through the first verse of Jerusalem the Golden. Kirk, the duty prefect, saunters up and down the aisles, making sure everyone is behaving. Suddenly, he stops right next to me and holds up his hand.
"Sir, sir, Fry is singing flat."
There is tittering. Mr. Hemus calls for hush.
"On your own, then, Fry."
I don't know what singing flat means, but I know it must be terrible.
"Come on!"
Hemus strikes his hand down on the keyboard to sound a chord and belts out the opening line in a strong tenor, "Jerusalem the Golden." I try to pick it up from there. "With milk and honey blessed." The school erupts with hoots of derisive laughter as a husky, tuneless squeak emerges from me.
"Yes, well, in future I think it would be better if you mimed," said Mr. Hemus.
Kirk grins triumphantly and moves on, and I am left alone, hot, pink, and quaking with humiliation, shame, and terror. The memory shrinks and moves away as Michael Joseph's reassuring modular tones continue to solace me.
"It has been a painful memory, but now it is one that makes you smile, for you can see that this is what has been locking up the music inside you all these years. Tomorrow evening you have to sing, yes?"
"Yes," my voice seeming to come from a long way away.
"When you have to sing, is there a, how you say, a cue? Is there some cue for you to sing?"
"Yes. My friend Hugh turns to me and says, 'Hit it, bitch.'"
"Hit it, bitch?"
"Hit it, bitch."
"Very good. Hit it, bitch. So tomorrow, when you stand before the audience, you will feel confident, happy, and filled with belief in your ability to triumph in this moment. And when you hear the words, 'Hit it, bitch,' all tensions and fears will melt away. This is the signal for you to be able easily to sing the song you need to sing. No fear, no tightness in the throat. Ease, confidence, assurance. Repeat that to me.
When I hear the words, 'Hit it, bitch,' all tensions and fears will melt away. It is the signal for me to be able to sing the song I need to sing. No fear, no tightness in the throat. Ease, confidence, assurance."
"Excellent. And now I shall pull on the rope and bring you up to the surface. As I pull, I count down from 20. When I reach 10, you will begin to awaken, refreshed and happy, quite able to remember our conversation and all its details. At 5, your eyes will begin to open. So, 20, 19.
I stumbled away, rather amazed that this memory of Kong Prak had been revealed, and fully confident that I would indeed be able to sing when the moment came. I believe I even hummed to myself as I walked from Maddox Street to the Oxford Street tube station. The following evening, I told Hugh that if he muffed his cue and said, "Hit it, baby," or "Cue it, bitch," or anything like that, then our whole enterprise would fail. All was well, the moment came, Hugh delivered the line correctly, and sounds came out of my mouth in more or less the right order, and employing more or less the correct musical pitches. Did the experience unlock singing for me? Absolutely not. I am as hopeless as ever I was. At weddings and funerals, I still prefer to mime. At John Schlesinger's funeral at a synagogue in St. John's Wood some years ago, the person I stood next to said to me encouragingly, "Come on, Stephen, you're not singing. Have a go." "Believe me, Paul, you don't want me to," I said. Besides, I was having a much better time listening to him. "No, go on." So I joined in the chorus. "You're right," Paul McCartney conceded. "You can't sing." I suppose in career terms, Saturday Live was a good move. It was watched by a large audience and generally went down well. It was especially successful for Ben, who moved from being a regular contributor to permanent host. His sign-off, "My name's Ben Elton, good night," became the catchphrase of the show, until Harry and Paul, tiring of the very successful Stavros, devised a new character for Harry to play. They came up with a loud-mouthed South London plasterer who fanned his wad of dosh at the audience and shouted, "Loads of money!" with gleeful, exultant braggadocio. He seemed to symbolise the second act of the Thatcher play, an era of materialism, greed and contempt for those left behind. As with Johnny Spate and Warren Mitchell's Alf Garnett, much of the audience seemed either to be deaf to or chose to disregard Paul and Harry's satirical intent, raising loads of money to almost folk-heroic status. Ben, Harry, Hugh and I fell into the habit of winding down after the recordings in a Covent Garden club called the Zanzibar, usually bringing with us the guest comedians or musicians of the week. Wedged in a semicircle of banquette one night, I had the opportunity of observing Robbie Coltrane's romantic and poetic seduction technique. He picked up the hand of the girl sitting next to him. "What fine, delicate hands you have," he said. "Why, thank you," said the girl. "I love women with small hands." "You do?" "I do. They make my cock look so much bigger." The Zanzibar swarmed with media people. Jimmy Mulville was often there. This sharp, witty, fast-brained Liverpudlian had been something of a legend in Cambridge, having left the year I arrived. He had gone up to read Latin and ancient Greek, and a less likely Cambridge classicist you could never hope to meet. The rumour was that his father, a docker from Walton, had come home one night when Jimmy was 17 and said, "You better do well in your A-levels and that, son, because I've just been to the bookies and put down a bet on you getting all A-grades and a scholarship to Cambridge. Got a good price, too." "Christ, Dad," Jimmy is reported to have said in shock, "how much did you bet?" "Everything," came the reply, "so get studying." They say that today's schoolchildren now suffer more exam pressure than my generation ever did, and generally I have no doubt that this is true, but I don't suppose many have had to endure pressure of the kind Jimmy did that year. He duly obliged with the straight A's and the scholarship. It is too good a story for me to check up and risk the disappointment of it being proved a distortion or exaggeration. What is certainly true is that when Jimmy arrived at Jesus in 1975, he brought a wife with him. It is not uncommon for people of a working-class background to wed before they are 20, but it is very uncommon for students to be married, and how the young Mrs. Mulville coped at Cambridge I do not know. Jimmy became president of the Footlights in 1977, and by the time I am writing about, he was starring in and writing the Channel 4 comedy Who Dares Wins with his Cambridge contemporary Rory McGrath. He would go on to found Hattrick, one of the first independent television production companies, famous for bringing shows like Have I Got News for You to television, and slightly less famous for giving shows like My Own This Is David Lander an airing. Who Dares Wins had established itself as something of a cult, singled out as being responsible for the post-closing time scheduling slot that Channel 4 made its own. Its beery style was not very close to the kind of thing Hugh and I did, but for me, the flashes of brilliance in the writing more than made up for its laddish manner. It gave the world one of my favourite jokes. There is something very pleasing about one-word punchlines. The show nearly always ended with a long, complex party scene shot in a one-camera single take. In one of these episodes, Jimmy approaches Rory and picks up a can of beer. Just as he's bringing it to his lips, Rory warns him, "I've just been using that as an ashtray, actually." Jimmy gives him a hard look, says, "Tough," and swigs. Another occasional habitué of the Zanzibar was the remarkable Peter Bennett Jones, also a Cambridge graduate, and now one of the most powerful managers, agents and producers in British television and film. I remember helping to give him the bumps outside the club at 2:30 on the morning of his 30th birthday, and watching in alarm as he dropped to the pavement and announced that he would now do 30 press-ups. "You're an old man," I said. "You'll give yourself a heart attack." PBJ, as he is universally known, did the 30 and then another 20, just because. A friend of mine claims that he was at a loose end in Hong Kong years ago. A hotel concierge recommended a restaurant. Go Kowloon side and ask for Cho Lies. On the quay at Kowloon, he was pointed to a junk that was just leaving. He leapt aboard. Cho Lies? He asked. Everyone on board nodded. After half an hour's chugging through choppy waters, he was dropped off on an island. Nothing. He thought he had been almost literally shanghaied. After what seemed an eternity, another junk futted its way to the jetty. Cho Lai! Called the skipper, and once more my friend hopped aboard. An hour followed, in which he ploughed deeper through the South China Sea, beginning to fear for his life. At last he was deposited on yet another island, but this time there was at least a restaurant, strung with lights and vibrating with music. Chow Lai himself came forward, a bonhomous fellow with an eye patch that completed the superbly Conradian feel of my friend's adventure. "Hello! You're very welcome. Tell me, you American?" "No, I'm English, as a matter of fact." "English! Ah, you know PBJ?" One wonders how many perplexed English customers had been asked that question without having the slightest idea who or what a PBJ might be. My friend did know, but doubted Chow Lai could possibly mean the same one. It turned out he certainly did. "Yeah, Pia Bang Jones!" My friend had a free dinner and a ride back to Kowloon in Chow Lai's private launch. There you have Peter Bennett Jones, with his long, lean frame, a line in crumpled linen suits, and a ripely old-fashioned, "dear old boy," manner. He looks and sounds the part of a superannuated colonial district commissioner from the pages of Somerset Maugham, yet is younger than Mick Jagger and as sharp, clever, and powerful a force in London's media world as you could find. I was fortunate, or unfortunate enough, to miss the evening at the Zanzibar when Keith Allen, one of the pioneers of alternative comedy and a man I was to come to know well, stood up on the bar and began to throw bottles back and forth, destroying much of the stock as well as most of the mirrors and fittings. Keith did get arrested, and on his return from a short stretch found himself permanently banned, or Zanzibarred, as I preferred to put it. The owner, Tony McIntosh, was good-natured enough not to exclude him from his new establishment, the Groucho, which he and Mary Lou Sturridge were on the point of opening in Soho. My years of hurling myself headlong into the world of Soho Bohemia were still ahead of me, but I was beginning to look at figures like Keith Allen with a kind of admiration tinged with fear. They seemed to own the London in which I still felt like a shy visitor, a London which was beginning to vibrate with enormous energy. I was afraid to enter the fashionable nightclubs, like the Titanic and the Limelight. After all, they seemed to be about nothing but dancing and getting drunk, neither of which I was very interested in, and even the Zanzibar was not a place I would ever dream of visiting except in a group. But a demon in me whispered that it was wrong for me to be nothing but a machine for churning out words. "You owe it to yourself to live a little, Harry," as Clint breathed to himself in Dirty Harry. Who was I at this time? I still found that people were bothered by my front, my ease, my apparent, effortlessness, invulnerability, lack of need. Something in me riled, perhaps, but mostly intrigued or baffled. Something in me intrigued or baffled triggered a mixture of exasperation and curiosity. How could somebody be so muffled up against the cruel winds of the world, so armed against the missiles of fate, so complete? Be great to see them drunk, see their guard down, find out what makes them tick. I really do believe that there are those who would like and trust me better if they saw me weeping into a whiskey, making a fool of myself, getting aggressive, maudlin, and drunkenly out of control. I have never found those states in others anything other than tiring, awkward, embarrassing, and fantastically dull, but I am quite sure that people would cherish a view of me in that condition at least once in a while. As it happens, I am almost never out of control, no matter how much I drink. My limbs may well lose coordination, but they have so little to begin with that it's hard to tell the difference. But I certainly never become aggressive or violent or weepy. That is clearly a fault. Back then, I could see that outsiders looking in on the Stephen Fry they encountered saw a man who had drawn life's winning lottery ticket. I did not seem to have it in me to project the vulnerability, fear, insecurity, doubt, inadequacy, puzzlement, and inability to cope that I so very often felt. The signs were writ large for those with the wit to read. The cars alone screamed so much, surely. An Aston Martin, a Jaguar XJ12, a Wolseley 1550, an Austin Healey 106 in concourse condition, an Austin Westminster, an MG Magnet, an MGB Roadster. People saw me riding around in these woody, leathery chariots and thought them the automobile equivalent of the tweed jacket and cavalry twills in which I still dressed myself. Good old Stephen. He's from another world, really. Quintessentially English. Old-fashioned values. Cricket, crosswords, classic cars, clubland. Bless. Or, they thought, pompous, smug Oxbridge twat and his young fogey brogues and snobby cars. What a git. And I thought, what a fraud. Half-Jewish puff who doesn't really know what he's doing or who he is, but is still the same sly, skulking, sweet-scoffing teenager he ever was, never quite fitting in, destroyed by love, incapable of being loved, unworthy of being loved. Till the day I die, people will always prefer to see me as strong, comfortable and English, like a good leather club chair. I have learned long ago not to fight it. Besides, and this is more than a question of good manners, although actually good manners are reason enough, why should anyone bleat on about what they feel inside all the time? It isn't dignified, it isn't interesting, and it isn't attractive. Any armchair psychologist can see that someone with my history of teenage Sturm and adolescent Drang, the needy sugar addiction, alienation, wild moods, unhappy sensualism, blighted romance, thieving, expulsions, fraud and imprisonment, who is suddenly given a new lease of life and the chance to work and make a preposterous amount of money, might well respond as I did, and make a series of silly and self-conscious attempts at display, to prove to himself and to the family whose life he made such a misery that he was now someone, someone who belonged. Look, I have cars and credit cards and club memberships and a country house. I know the name of the head waiter at Le Caprice. I am stitched into England like connelized leather into the seat of an Aston. If asked, I would have told you that I was happy. I was happy. I was content, certainly, which is to happy what Pavillon Rouge is to Chateau Margaux, I suppose, but which will have to do for most of us. Saturday Live was adjudged a hit, and perhaps as a result of our appearances on it, Hugh and I were summoned once more to Jim Moyer's office to see if we couldn't waggle our cocks in the air and get someone to kneel and suck, or put a show together, as other, lesser comedy executives might have put it. After the BBC's lack of interest in the Crystal Cube, we were leery about high-concept programmes and determined that we should have a shot at committing to screen what we knew best, sketch comedy.
Excellent, said Richard Armitage. You can do that next year. But first, Stephen...
He rubbed his hands together and his eyes gleamed.
Broadway.
Clipper class, coat basque and choreography. Mike Ockrent and I flew to New York together in clipper class, Pan Am's equivalent of business, where you could eat and drink and smoke until your eyes, liver and lungs bubbled. We had a few days, and our job was to dazzle Richard's potential financiers and co-producers. Robert Lindsay was already there. This was my first ever trip to the United States, and I had to keep hugging myself. I had often fantasized about America as a child and felt that when I got there I should find that I already knew it and love it all the more for that. I shan't distress you too much with my thoughts about the Manhattan skyline. If you haven't visited New York City yourself, you've seen it in film and television, and you know that there are a lot of very, very tall buildings crowded together on a relatively small island. You will know there are long tunnels and rattly bridges. There is a central oblong park, wide avenues that run arrow straight down from one end to the other, rhythmically intersected by numbered streets. You will know that the avenues also have numbers, except when they are called Madison Park, Lexington, Amsterdam, or West End. You will know there is just one exception, one daring diagonal thoroughfare that carves its way down from the top left corner of the island, ignoring the symmetry of the grid, creating squares, circuses, and slivered scalenes of open space as it slices its way southwest. Verdi Square, Dante Park, Columbus Circle, Madison Square, Herald Square, Union Square. You will know that this outlaw diagonal is called Broadway. You will know, too, that where Broadway meets 42nd Street at Times Square, the heart of New York theatre beats, and has done so for 100 years. I walked around the theatre district, rubbernecking the neon, bowing to the statue of George M. Cohan. Give my regards to Broadway, it says on the plinth, and to this day I get a lump in my throat every time I see that, more out of veneration for James Cagney's impersonation of him than out of love or knowledge of Cohan himself. Seating myself in the Carnegie Deli to write postcards, subjecting myself to the overwhelming rudeness of the waiters and trying to make sense of a Rubens special. Everything in New York is exactly what you expect, and yet it still astonishes you. Had I come to Manhattan and found that the avenues were winding and bendy, the buildings low and squat, and the people slow, drawling, and kindly, and that there was no trace of that fabled charge of energy that you drew from the very pavements as you walked on them, then I would have had cause to blink and shake my head in wonder. As it is, the town was precisely what I knew it would be, what legend, fable, literature, and Tin Pan Alley had long reported it to be. Down to the clouds of steam blooming from the manholes, the boat-like wallow of the huge checker cabs as they bounced and flipped their tires on the great iron sheets that seemed to have been casually slung by a giant onto the surface of the street, and the strange smoky whiff at every street corner that turned out on inquiry to be the smell of new-baked pretzel, just what I had always known. Yet every 5 steps I took, I could not but stop and grin and gasp and stretch my eyes at the theatre of it all, the noise and rudeness and vitality. Affirmation of what we absolutely expect comes as more of a shock than disaffirmation. Richard's possible colleagues for the Broadway production were 2 Americans, James Niederlander, who seemed to own half the theatres in America, and Terry Allen Kramer, who seemed to own half the real estate in Manhattan. They were serious and hard-boiled business people. They had it in their heads that the British couldn't choreograph, and when an American producer has an idea in their head, nothing can shift it, not Mr. Muscle, not TNT, not electric shock treatment. Jimmy Niederlander was convinced he knew the secret of a good musical.
"It's got to have heart,"
he told me over lunch at the Cote Basque on 55th Street with Terry, Mike and Robert.
"I saw your show in London and I said to my wife, 'Honey, this show has got fucking heart. It's got fucking heart. We should do it.' She agreed."
"It's got to have proper choreography too," growled Terry.
Terry Allen Kramer liked to say that while she wasn't the richest woman in America, she certainly paid more tax than any woman in America. She had at one time owned majority shares in Columbia Pictures, as well as having large quantities of oil money and property, including the block on which the Cote Basque, made famous by Truman Capote, stood. When I had arrived there for the lunch appointment, I had found myself almost paralysed by the snootiness of the waiters. New York is an infinitely ritzier and more class-bound city than London. White-gloved, liveried and top-lofty elevator attendants, doormen, chauffeurs and maitre d' can make life hell for those without social confidence. Adrift on an alien shore, all the ease I had amassed over the years that allowed me to meet a head waiter's eye squarely at the Ritz or Le Caprice now deserted me. Abroad is bloody, as George VI liked to say. Abroad, no matter how high you have climbed the ladders at home, forces you to slide down the snakes and start again.
"Yes?"
hissed the waiter who had floated up to me as I had glanced with overdone nonchalance around the dining room, the very effort of projecting a casual, proprietorial air, betraying all the illness at ease and inferiority I was feeling. Well, I'm meeting some people for lunch. I'm afraid I'm a little early. Should I, sorry.
Name?
Stephen Fry, sorry.
Let me see. I find no reservation under that name.
Oh, sorry. No, that's my name. Sorry.
Oh, and in what name is the reservation?
I think probably in the name of Kramer. Sorry. Do you have a table in the name of Terry Allen Kramer?
It was as if the current had suddenly been switched on. A smile lit up the waiter's whole countenance. His body language transformed itself from drooping contempt to drooling abasement, quivering attention and hysterical respect.
Sir, I'm sure Mrs. Kramer would love for you to be seated and maybe have a glass of champagne or a cocktail. Would you like something to read while you wait? Mrs. Kramer is usually 10 minutes late, so perhaps some olives, an ashtray, anything, anything at all. Thank you, sir.
Lordy! And indeed she had been 10 minutes late, sweeping in and gathering up Jimmy Niederlander, Mike Ockrent, and Robert Lindsay, who by this time had joined me on the uncomfortable ante-room sofa. A telephone had been brought to the table and plugged into a socket by the wall for her as we sat down. Through this she had hollered instructions to minions at her office during the course of lunch. When it came time for pudding, she looked around the table.
"Who wants dessert? You guys want dessert?"
I nodded with enthusiasm, and she loudly clapped her hands.
"André, get the pastry cart."
Le chariot à pâtisserie was duly wheeled before us, loaded with exquisite délices. Terry Allen Kramer pointed at one more than ordinarily luxurious tower of cream, glazed pastry, and crystallized fruits.
"What's that?"
she barked. André went into his spiel. "Madame, it is a mousseline of almondine and nougatine, whipped into a sabayon of praline and souffline," and so forth. Cutting him short, Terry positioned her hand over the pristine surface of this gorgeous creation, and with one long pull dug up a great scoop of it, sucked it from her fingers with a loud smack, cocked her head to one side, thought for a moment, and then said, turning her head away from the waiter as she did so, "Take it away, it's shit." Robert and I stared with open mouths. Mike later suggested that she did this to impress us with her ruthlessness, to make us aware that we were expendable and that she took no prisoners. I simply thought it was the single most ghastly thing I had ever seen a human do, and I had once seen a man take his cock out and piss all over the desk of a 4-star hotel lobby, splashing a receptionist and 2 bystanders. Terry noticed that we were looking at her and smiled grimly. "The dessert was shit. Shit is shit. Did I say about how important the choreography is?" If that lunch had been a test, we somehow passed it, and Terry and Jimmy duly agreed to pony up. I went back to England, and Hugh and I set about starting to write for next year's pilot of a Fry and Laurie TV sketch show. "We should do a tour," Hugh said.
"A tour?
If we agree to a live show around the country, then that will force us to write material for it. We're not allowed to do Shakespeare Masterclass or Dracula, only new material." Although we were not really well known, and certainly nothing like as famous as Harry and Ben were becoming, there was a sizable enough demand for us in college and university towns, it seemed, and a tour was arranged. We wrote and stared out of the window and paced up and down and bought Big Macs and looked out of the window and went for walks and tore at our hair and swore and watched television and bought more Big Macs and swore again and wrote and screamed with horror as the clock showed that another day was over, and we looked at what we had written and groaned and agreed to meet again first thing next day, whosever turn it was agreeing to arrive with some coffee and Big Macs. After we had assembled some material, I had to go back to New York for Me and My Girl rehearsals. The plan was for me to return after the opening. We would tour and record a one-off Fry and Laurie pilot show to be screened at Christmas and followed the next year by a series. Me and My Girl rehearsed in Manhattan, somewhere down near the Flatiron Building.
I had never seen such facilities or met with such order in the course of a theatrical venture. There was a dance room, a song room, and even a book room, a huge space dedicated to rehearsing my bits and my bits alone. I even had my own writer's room off it, handsomely supplied with desk, electric typewriter, stationery, and coffee percolator. Mike Ockrent led the same production team, but only Robert remained from the British cast. N. Rytel had taken over from him in London and would be followed by Gary Wilmot, Carl Howman, Brian Connolly, Les Dennis and many others in the course of its long run. Here in New York, Robert had Mary Ann Plunkett, whom I had seen in Sunday in the Park with George, playing opposite him as Sally and George S. Irving as Sir John. I stayed at the Wyndham, an old-fashioned actor's hotel on 58th Street, whose rooms were spacious, chintzy suites with bathrooms and fittings that believed it was still 1948. By each bed was a white telephone with no dial or buttons. When you picked up the receiver, it connected you to the front desk. "I'd like to make a call," you would tell the operator. You gave the number you wanted and hung up. 5 minutes or half an hour later, according to whim or luck, the phone would ring and you would be through. Most nights at about 2 or 3, I would be jerked awake by the phone's crashing buzz. "Yes?"
"Your call to Rome, Italy."
"I didn't ask for a call to Rome."
"My mistake. Wrong number. Thank you."
At breakfast, I fell into the habit of chatting with some of the long-term guests, almost all of them actors or theatre people. A favourite was Raymond Burr, enormously bulky but very kindly and cheerful, despite the habitually tired bloodhound droop of his eyes. He went so far as to ask my advice about doing more Perry Mason on television.
"Do young people remember it?"
"Well, I have to confess it was before my time," I said to him, "but I loved Ironside."
"Why, thank you. They don't want to do any more Ironside, but there is talk of more Perry Mason. You never saw it?"
"I'm sure television could do with a really good legal series. He was a lawyer, that is right."
"Oh, my, I shall have to tell the producers. I met a smart young Englishman, and he had barely heard of Perry Mason. Oh, my."
If Raymond Burr wasn't available for conversation, I had in another corner of the breakfast room Broadway's ancient royal couple, Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy. They spoke to me through each other.
"Oh, look, honey, here's the English fellow. I wonder how his rehearsals are going."
"Not too bad," I would reply. "The cast seem amazing to me."
"He says the cast is amazing. Is he confident of a hit, I wonder?"
"Oh, well, you know, it's pretty much in the lap of the gods." By which I mean the lap of the critics, I suppose.
"He's calling the critics gods, honey. Did you hear that? Gods!" And so on.
Once rehearsals kicked in, I saw something of the American work ethic. Competition for parts in the chorus was so tough that they never relaxed. During time off, the boys and girls were teaching each other new steps, practicing vocal scales and warming up or down according to the time of day, and drinking water all the time. We are now so used to it all over the Western world that one has to remind oneself that there was a time when young Americans didn't feel naked without a bottle of water in their hands. I also saw something of the meaning of the star system. It is a kind of paradox of America, the republic that freed itself of the inequitable shackles of monarchy, class, and social rank, that it chooses to privilege stars with a status far beyond that of any European duke or prince. As with any true aristocracy, the principles of noblesse oblige apply to stars. Robert told me of the time they all went upstate to film a TV commercial. It was a long and tiring day in humid summer. Chorus members were clanking around in medieval armour, pearly suits and fur-lined cloaks, and take after take was called for. As the shoot wore on, Robert noticed a diminution in friendliness towards him that he could not understand. He asked Mary Ann Plunkett whether he had done something wrong. "Everyone is very tired and very hot, and I think they'd like it to be over."
"Well, yes, me too," said Robert. "But how is that my fault?"
"Robert, you're the star. You're the company leader. You decide if it's time for everyone to wrap and go home."
But...
Robert, of course, had been brought up in the self-consciously we're-all-mates-here cooperative atmosphere of British theatre, where no one would ever dare pull starry rank. Because we have a class system in Britain, we go out of our way to make sure that it is made plain that everyone is absolutely equal. Because America doesn't, they seem to revel in the power, status and prestige that achievement can bring. Robert, it's your duty to make decisions for us. Swallowing nervously and grateful that none of his British contemporaries were witnessing the moment, he spoke up to the director in front of everyone. Right, Tommy, one more take only, and then everyone needs to get out of costume and be on their way.
Sure, Bob, said the director. Absolutely, whatever you say.
Everybody smiled, and Robert learned the duties and responsibilities of stardom. Me and my girl tried out in downtown Los Angeles in the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, then best known as the location of the annual Academy Awards ceremony. I stayed at the Biltmore Hotel off Pershing Square, almost near enough the theatre to walk. This was Los Angeles, of course, and as everyone knows, walking is never done there. Besides, when you have rented a bright red convertible Mustang, you want to use it at every opportunity. There was really very little for me to do other than attend the early performances and occasionally offer new snatches of dialogue as required. After a week at the Biltmore, charming as it was, I thought I might as well blow all my per diems on a weekend at the Bel Air Hotel. For the low, low price of $1,500 a night, I had a little bungalow and a beautiful garden in which my own private hummingbird flitted about just for me. On the second night, I invited the chorus, who somehow jammed themselves in, drank $600 worth of wine and liquor, and vamoosed in a cloud of kisses and extravagant gratitude. L.A. was our only tryout town, and the show had gone well enough in front of a mostly elderly subscription audience. Broadway was next, and from here there was no escape and no second chances. It is a known oddity of the New York theatre world that a production is made or broken almost solely by its review in the New York Times. It is the paper, incidentally, not the reviewer, that wields this terrible power. As Bernard Levin once observed, a Barbary ape could hold the post of Times reviewer and still have the power to close a show. Frank Rich was the current Barbary ape that we had to please, and there was no knowing until the night whether his thumb would go up or down. If it went down, the whole production would fold. Jimmy, Terry and Richard would lose their money, and the cast would all be fired. Humiliation all round. We had already earned a certain measure of ill will in the town by being the first show to open in the Marriott Marquis Theatre, built as part of a major Times Square reconstruction project. To make way for an enormous new hotel, the much-loved Helen Hayes Theatre had been pulled down to such a howl of impassioned protest that the Marriott Group promised to integrate a new theatre into the development, and the Marquis was it. At the dress rehearsal, nerves were frayed, and Jimmy Niederlander and Terry Allen Kramer, being denied, as producers, any other outlet for their tension than the pleasure of firing people, had scented blood. Their old insecurity on the issue of the dance numbers resurfaced, and sitting behind them I heard mutters and growls about Gillian Gregory, the choreographer. How they thought firing her the day before previews began could possibly help, I do not know, but I suppose plenty of shows had been rescued in shorter time than that. I assume they liked the idea of bringing in Tommy Tune or Bob Fosse or some other legend of dance, having them work everyone 18 hours a day for 3 days, and then telling the world how they had fired asses and saved the show. American entertainment tycoons do like to see themselves cast in the mythological, tough, uncompromising son-of-a-bitch mould. Theatre people hate dramatics. They get enough of that at work. Non-theatre people dramatise everything around them. I caught hold of Richard Armitage and mentioned that I had heard grumblings. He said, "I shall have to do something about that." We sat and watched an energetic but somehow spiritless dress rehearsal. The new theatre smelled of carpet glue and wood varnish. It had fluorescent strips for house lights, which meant that they couldn't be faded up or down, but only flickered on and off, killing the atmosphere. Even when they went out, the exit signs were so brightly lit you could easily read your program from their lurid spill. The doors at the back of the auditorium were horribly oversprung, such that no matter how gently you tried to close them, they made a terrible bang, and if people didn't know about them and let them go without care, it was as if a gunshot had gone off. The dancing had been, to my untutored non-specialist eye, spectacular, but Terry Allen Kramer scribbled savagely in her notebook every time a leg kicked or a body twirled. When finally the curtain came down for the ending, she stood and opened her mouth. "The choreo—" Richard's voice drowned her out. "Damn! Well, those house lights are a disaster. And the doors and the exit signs. But there's nothing we can do about that in time for the first preview. Just nothing. It would take a miracle." Terry uttered a harsh bark. "Nothing? Ha! That's what you think. There's plenty we can do. Bill Marriott is a personal friend. I don't care if I have to wake him up. He'll goddamn sort this out. Someone get me a phone right now." Off she went, steaming and puffing like the ironclad destroyer she was. Orders were issued and issues ordered. Bill Marriott was jerked from his European slumbers, and in under an hour, electricians were being elevated to the ceiling on scissor lifts, and men in white overalls were removing door springs at the back of the house. In her commanding glory, Terry had forgotten all about the choreography. I shook Richard by the hand. "Masterly," I said. "If I had a hat, I'd take it off to you." By the first preview, the atmosphere of the show began to be restored. The doors were now, of course, whisper quiet, the exit signs glowed gently, and the house lights were warm and sweetly controllable. I had moved out of the Wyndham and was staying in a most glorious apartment on 59th Street, Central Park South, with a matchless view of the park and Fifth Avenue. It belonged to Douglas Adams, who, with typical generosity, had told me to make free of it. I held a nervous party there the evening of the first night. My parents had flown over, as had Hugh. My great-aunt Dieter, who had escaped the Nazis in Salzburg and come over to America in the 1940s, was a formidable and terrifying presence. She offered Hugh one of her untipped Pall Mall cigarettes. "That's very kind," said Hugh, taking out a full-strength but filtered Marlboro Red. "I prefer these." "You some kind of health nut?" said my aunt, thrusting her pack towards him. "Take!" Hugh, being the polite fellow he is, took one. Neither Mike Cochran nor I could face being in the auditorium with the first night audience. The knowledge that Frank Rich had already been and written his review, and that it would be out in just a few hours, was almost more than we could bear. We paced up and down in the foyer, consuming gin and tonic after gin and tonic, becoming more and more hysterical with panic, terror, and a sense of the absurdity of the whole venture. Our pacing routes would converge, and we kept bumping into each other, which caused us to burst into fresh fits of manic laughter. "We are at the first night of our own Broadway show," Mike kept saying, shaking his head in disbelief. "It can't be true. Someone is going to wake me up." I repeated those lines from the producers that everybody quotes at first nights. "Wow, this play wouldn't run a night. A night? Are you kidding? This play's guaranteed to close on page 4. How could this happen? I was so careful. I picked the wrong play, the wrong director, the wrong cast. Where did I go right?" And so on. Years later, Mike would collaborate with Mel Brooks on The Producer's Reinvention as a stage musical, only to be struck down with incurable leukemia before he had the chance to see it open as the biggest Broadway hit of its day. During the second half, just after the audience had gone back in from the interval, Ralph Rosen, the company's general manager, waddled in his amiable, flat-footed way across the lobby to whisper to us the news that a friend of a friend had a friend whose friend was dating a friend at the New York Times, and that their friend had seen an advance copy of the Frank Rich review, and that it was good. It was more than good. It was a rave. Ralph solemnly shook our hands. He was the most quiet-spoken, honourable and matter-of-fact person I'd met in America. If he said a thing was so, then it was so, and not otherwise. By the time we all assembled upstairs for the party, Richard had a copy in his hands and a wetness in his eyes once more.
At the Antoinette Perry Awards later that year, Me and My Girl was nominated for 13 Tonys. We failed to pick up 10 of them, my category included, but Robert and Marianne each won for Best Performance in a Musical, and perhaps most pleasingly of all, Gillian Gregory won for Best Choreography. I don't know if to this day she is aware how adeptly Richard saved her from being pointlessly and unjustifiably fired. I got back to England still shaken by my good fortune. Me and My Girl was running in the West End and on Broadway. There were productions in Tokyo, Budapest, Australia, Mexico. I've forgotten the other territories. The show would run on Broadway for the next 3.5 years, and in the West End for another 6. In the meantime, there was Fry and Laurie to look forward to, another Blackadder, and who knew what else? It seemed that I was an insider, a show business somebody. In August 1987, I was at home in Norfolk congratulating myself on having given up smoking for 10 days. Hugh, Kim, and other friends came up to help me celebrate my 30th birthday, and within 10 minutes of their arrival, I was back on the cigarettes. My roaring 20s were over, and next month Hugh and I would start work on our BBC pilot, which we planned to call A Bit of Fry and Laurie. My bank balance was good and getting even better. I had cars, certainty, and a slowly growing name. I was the luckiest person I knew. Never one to take stock or make inventories, I do recall standing in the garden of the Norfolk House, watching the sun set and feeling that I had finally arrived. I do not believe that I actually crowed over the remains of my miserable past self, but I came perhaps as close to exultation as a person can. When someone exults, fate's cruel lips curl into a smile. C. Back in London some weeks later, an actor friend asked me if I fancied a line. I did not even know what he meant, but I said that I certainly would like one, because he had asked in a way that made a line sound intriguing and wicked and fun. I thought perhaps he was going to tell me a quite appalling joke or pick-up line. Instead, he took a packet of folded paper from his pocket, dug out some white powder, and chopped it up into 2 lines on the surface of a smoked glass coffee table. He asked me if I had a £10 note. I produced one, and he rolled it up tight and put it to one nostril. He sniffed up half of his line, applied the rolled-up £10 note to the other nostril, and sniffed up the other half. I came forward, took the tube, knelt down, and did the same, reproducing his actions as carefully as I could. The powder stung my nostrils enough to produce a few tears in my eyes. I went back to my chair, and we sat and talked for a while. After 20 or 30 minutes, we did the same thing again, and then a third time. By now, I was buzzing and garrulous and wide awake and happy. I did not know it, but this was to mark the beginning of a new act of my life. The tragedy and farce of that drama are the material for another book. In the meantime, thank you for your company.